Welcome to Talking Paper. I'm Christian Needon. For this episode, I speak with Claire Durand-Gaslin, Craig Kite, and Brian Sheffield, who are three of the co-founding editors, along with Margot Talou, of Post Blank, a French-American, bilingual, word art publication from Mad Gleam Press. The publication's first volume, titled Post Paper, debuted with 92 pages. The second volume, Post Mortem, with 144 pages. The Mad Gleam Press website describes its mission as highlighting, quote, the conjoined strengths of text and image by publishing visual poetic pieces, visual poems, dialogues on arts and ideas between artists of the two media, and excerpts of artist books. We also want to celebrate and speak to the infrastructure of the physical communities that come together around small press publications. We hope to offer a space for visual and literary artists to complement each other's work and to make new connections across mediums, genres, and cultures. The Mad Gleam summary of the content found in Postmortem states, quote, death less represents the romantic stuff of tragedy as much as a shirked inevitability, viewed indirectly through the rosy lens of metaphor or through some white frowning mask. Death is a hard-nosed fact checked on the ice of stark reality, an open-eyed kiss and reason to fuck, to connect, to practice life. We can only understand the constant flux of our experience, collective or individual, through reflection, taking stabs at post-analysis, even if only via abstract expression. In our own ways, we attempt to make sense of these things without it shaving any days off our lives. So allow yourself a reminder. Touch the bone inside your skin, tickle your mortality, and understand that nothing ever has been, currently is, nor ever will be, permanent. I began this Talking Paper interview by asking each of the three Post Blank editors to read an excerpt from Postmortem.
So this is in memory of the poet John Foxhall, who passed away in Staten Island in December. I was having a snail mail correspondence with him. He didn't have a email or a phone, and I had met him at the Parkside Lounge and took this page of one of his poems, and that which he gave to me, and after he passed away, I decided to publish it in this issue here. Transparent. My body burns with fever in a sick hell. My body wanted children. My mind did not. It seems the whole world is on fire this summer, but I live in an icy cave of my own making. For fun, I hang out on the fire escape, tossing gnawed-on bones down to the streets below, where flaming forms dance and shimmer on their way to buy groceries or heroin. I am more a creature of a night than I am workday song on someone's AM radio. I live in mortal dread of being forced to take the Staten Island ferry, aware that the one time I do is when the boat will go down to the depths with me on board. The darkest day of the year is moving closer, yet I walk in a dense fog. Every day of the year, so what difference does it all make? Tap water is thicker than the blood coursing through my veins. I eat bananas and turn their skins into long dangling earrings to adorn myself in silverback gorilla quasi-finery so I can scare the piss out of those kids clustered below my fire escape, waiting to see the crazy man strut and pound his chest, daring them to call him grandfather.
Thank you, Craig. Claire, tell me about the piece you're going to read.
So it's actually an excerpt from Victor Hugo's Book of the Table, which is his less known work. So I'm going to read it in French first with my introduction and like a first dialogue. It's basically spirit sessions that Victor Hugo did during 2 years. So let's go for the French first. Il y a des livres qui vous intriguent, puis d'autres qui vous bouleversent. Des livres à la belle langue, puis des livres où les mots semblent dépasser toutes les significations que vous avez pu leur donner jusqu'alors. Le livre des tables a été de cela pour moi. Contexte. De 1853 à 1855, en réaction au coup d'État du 2 décembre 1851, perpétré par Louis-Napoléon Bonaparte, Victor Hugo est en exil à Jersey. Il habite à Marine Terrace, une maison isolée en bord de mer, près d'un cimetière. Dans ce décor empreint de surnaturel, avec sa famille et quelques proches, Hugo va se livrer quasi quotidiennement à des séances de spiritisme, initiées par Delphine de Girardin. Il discute avec des esprits inconnus ou célèbres et des formes abstraites et symboliques. Les séances sont retranscrites dans des cahiers qui serviront à établir le livre des tables dont Hugo envisageait une publication posthume. Cette période de l'histoire de Victor Hugo est souvent décrite comme empreinte de folie. Les historiens et experts ont trouvé des dizaines d'explications rationnelles et rassurantes sur les phénomènes ici relatés, invoquant la schizophrénie, la télépathie entre les participants ou encore l'écriture automatique. On pourrait en parler, j'aurais certainement 1000 objections, et au final, peu importe. Vous n'avez pas besoin d'y croire pour être touché, car ce qui compte vraiment ici sont les mots, sublimes et bouleversants. Que leur auteur soit l'écrivain lui-même ou les esprits cités, cette œuvre contient toute la puissance, la poésie et la profondeur du génie d'Hugo. Dimanche 11 septembre 1853. Qui es-tu, âme saurore? De qui es-tu la sœur? Doute. Ton pays? France. Ta ville? Pas de réponse. Es-tu heureuse? Oui. Où es-tu? Lumière. Que faut-il pour aller à toi? Aimer. Qui t'envoie? Bon Dieu. As-tu quelque chose à nous dire? Oui. Quoi? Souffrez pour l'autre monde. Vois-tu la souffrance de ceux qui t'aiment? Oui. Souffreront-ils longtemps? Non. Rentreront-ils bientôt en France? Pas de réponse. Es-tu contente quand ils mêlent ton nom à la prière? Oui. Es-tu toujours auprès d'eux? Veilles-tu sur eux? Oui. Dépend-il d'eux de te faire revenir? Non. Mais reviendras-tu? Oui. Bientôt? Oui.
And now the English.
There are books that intrigue you and others that deeply move you. Books with fine and beautiful words and books where words seem to go beyond all the meanings you have been able to give them so far. The Book of the Tables was one of these for me. Here is a context. From 1853 to 1855, Victor Hugo is in exile on the Isle of Jersey, as a result of Louis-Napoléon Bonaparte coup d'état in December 2nd of 1851. He lives in Marine Terrace, a house both by the sea and a cemetery. Victor Hugo will spend the next 2 years in this uncanny setting with his family and a few close friends, devoting himself almost daily to the sessions of spiritism initiated by Delphine de Girardin. He converses with illustrious spirits and abstract ideas. The sittings are recorded in minutes, which will serve to establish the Book of the Tables, of which Hugo envisaged a posthumous publication. This period of Victor Hugo's history is often described as being a brush with madness. Historians and experts have found dozens of rational and reassuring explanations of the phenomena described here, invoking automatic writing or even telepathy between participants. We could talk about it. I will certainly have 1,000 objections. And in the end, it does not matter. You do not need to believe in it to be touched. What really matters here are the sublime and overwhelming words. Whether the author is a writer himself or the spirits quoted, the work contains all the power, poetry, and depth of Hugo's genius. Sunday, 11 September 1853. Who are you? A sisterly cell. Whose sister are you? Doubt. Your country? France. Your city? No answer. Are you happy? Yes. Where are you? Light. What must one do to be where you are? Love. Who sends you? The good Lord. Do you have anything to say to us? Yes. What? Suffer for the other world. Do you see the suffering of those who love you? Yes. Will they suffer for a long time? No. Will they soon return to France? No answer. Are you happy when they mix your name with prayer? Yes. Are you always with them? Are you watching over them? Yes. Does it depend on them to make you come back? No. But will you come back? Yes. Soon? Yes.
Thank you, Claire. Brian, tell me about the piece you're going to read.
Funny enough, Craig and Claire both have very good, well-put, legitimate reasons for choosing their piece. I, on the other hand, do not, other than the fact that I personally enjoyed it. I liked it when I read it for the first time. I have no idea right now who George Guida is because I do not have the email or any information in front of me. But from the writing, I can tell that he's a fantastic writer. I also really appreciate what the piece is within the context of its double page. So there's an image of Jesus Christ with his head being torn off from a Tyrannosaurus Rex, which I think is a funny, funny image of religion and death. Right next to it is a poem called In the Realm of the Disney Princess, then Scarface, which is George Guida's poem, and The Weak Prince Died. So I like this because it's this whole page dedicated to the idea of idols and really the death of these idols and what that represents, whether it's funny or serious. And I think in so many ways it kind of represents what a lot of this book is. The book's about death. It's the way that the artists represent death in various ways through their writing or drawing or painting, etc. And oftentimes death is very sad. Other times it's hysterical. I mean, you know, you have the Darwin Awards, which are famously, you know, hysterical. You have plenty of comedies about death, you know, plenty of sad movies about death. So I think from there, I'm just going to go on ahead. Scarface. The night Tony Montana died, 1,000 bullets and a balcony plunge face first into an indoor fountain. Johnny Farrell next to me up front stood and yelled, "Shoot him again! Drive him to the bottom!" The truth. We hadn't yet gone our separate ways. Johnny, a fireman now, trusted me enough to call the short bus playground Tardo Park. I wasn't a teacher then, that year when he was my best friend, the one I most wanted to be, good-looking, tough, in that Irish way. We plaited weights and walked the town. 15 in tight jeans and t-shirts. Girls would yell from passing cars, but never stopped to talk. Good, because our mouths spat blanks. We bled ketchup over share-drawn longings. Johnny told the biggest kid in school he wished he had his size. If only what he'd do, then laughed at the lack. Then, and now, I tried not to suspend disbelief. Not Johnny, who believed in Al Pacino's stuntman's fall, while I see my gangster corpse still floating there.
Thank you, Brian. One of my favorite movies. So, Claire, shifting back over to you, considering that you read your piece both in French and in English, that seems an excellent entree to the idea of post-blank. Tell me the idea behind the publication.
So the idea, I think, is all about dialogues in a lot of ways. So first, we have the dialogues between visual art and writings. We wanted to show, like, the what we call the conjoint strength of writing and images. And I'm a visual artist, like Margot, who's also on the team back in France. And we're with, like, so we're two French artists female with two American poets male, which is kind of doing the trick, I guess. So first, it's all about this dialogue, and I think it's also about this dialogue between French and American culture. I guess there are, like, for me, it really comes from this desire to show American people some parts of French culture that is not going to be showed to them at first, like something more than just a baguette and beret and lipstick kind of thing.
You guys publish in English and in French. Tell me about the challenges of translating.
Which is actually the biggest part of the work with the design, I think, is the translations. I think it's very interesting in the dialogue it forms when we are actually doing the translations. It's a very difficult exercise, especially when you're not a professional translator, and none of us is. Even if I am bilingual, Alex, who's helping us, is also bilingual. But, you know, there are still, like, a lot of subtleties. A language is not just a language, it's a whole culture. So to actually translate is to, like, take a text and try to change the context of its piece so that people who are going to read it in another context are still going to get the point of this piece. So I think it's more than just, like, translating the words. It's really, like, sometimes we had to change words. You know, I was, like, talking to you before about the word pilgrim, for example, which is a very American word, and that is when you say pilgrim, it has all those aspects of like the actual history of the United States. And it's a word that you guys are going to use in that context. But for us, when you say pilgrim, which is a pèlerin, so like when you go on a pilgrimage, it has nothing to do with the United States. So we had to find another word and translate it, something that is more in the idea of like colonizing than the idea of pilgrimage. I think it was actually a good example for that.
What was the word you guys settled on?
Colon, which is, I don't know if you guys have this actual word in English. So it's like colonizer, but it doesn't have like the negative kind of aspect in it, because pilgrim is not inherently negative. It's just like, it's a word that's kind of neutral. It's just like you use it in a way or another. So colon is like something that we would use actually like in France to describe people who would like colonize French colonies. But before it was seen as a crime against humanity, of course. So I think it's a pretty neutral word. So yeah, I'm not sure it's the best choice, but that's the best choice that we could make.
Just to give an example, this one essay I wrote that was in the first issue, there was a line that went something to the effect of, how many football fields of bison do I have to clear in order to shake some dough out of the old bread basket's budget for the arts? And she had no idea how to translate that in the French, because there's a lot of cultural references there in the line. So we struggle with the cultural references, I do believe.
And every piece that makes it to every issue of Post Blank is going to be in these two versions. Brian, you mentioned the piece that you read appealed to you. When you read it originally, and you were vetting pieces for this issue, I assume you read it in English.
I did read it in English, yes.
Let's start off with this. How is your French?
My French is borderline non-existent. But I do at least want to get this off my chest. We do not at first think about what the French translation is going to be like when we're looking for pieces. We look for pieces that we feel are going to fit the theme and are going to have a good conversation with everything that's going on. Granted, we're still learning how to do this. I don't know how everybody else feels about this, but I like to have this sense of honesty that is even like aware of its own mistakes, if you will. One of the biggest challenges that we had in this magazine is putting everything together after we've already emailed everybody saying that we've accepted it without actually putting everything in the order that it's going to be in, right? So the main thing that we do look for is we look for pieces that fit the theme and will have a good conversation within further issues we've also learned that are also going to look good together on the page and are going to work well together as single double pages that you could look at. Because, you know, as you go through the magazine, each double page kind of represents its own kind of story or its own kind of image or its own kind of interpretation of the theme in one way or another. The French translation comes afterwards, but we do not take this into consideration when accepting pieces. And I feel like to a certain degree that's kind of important to note, especially since you do come across so many of those cultural walls that language has a lot of difficulty climbing over. You know, like Craig said in his piece, or like any of these other pieces in here that have these idioms that are heavily rooted in, say, American or French culture.
Let's stick with the idea of theme. Tell me about the theme of this issue of Post Blank.
The theme is, the name is Postmortem, which immediately is death. That can be looked at in so many different ways. On one hand, there's the physicality of it and the emotion surrounding it. You know, just death right there at the end. You know, you could put it something like that. And then, you know, so much poetry. The oldest poetry in history is about sex and death. You know what I mean? Like, because that's basically you know, other than taxes, right? Like,
inescapable.
Those are basically the things that are guaranteed in life is like death and taxes, right? There's that saying. There's also the political spectrum, right? I don't think we need to talk about politics right at this moment, since what's going on right now is so prevalent. Everybody kind of knows that there's this massive division and that there's just this idea of some form of deathness in the air, whether it's like the death of a certain age that we sort of have claimed in one way or another, you know, that we've named or that we haven't even named yet. There's like the death of unity to certain degrees because things are so wildly divided. There's the death of decency. If you even want to give like a definition of decency to a certain degree, there's even a death of definition and a death of truth. I don't think it's easy to talk about without creating extremes. You know what I mean? And I really try to avoid doing that. But then when I talk about it, I find myself going into the abstraction and really pinpointing extremes without meeting a middle ground. So it's really hard for me to find my thoughts properly and go in that direction. But ultimately, we wanted to take postmortem because, you know, postmortem's a phrase. We love the idea of it in general. It works perfectly well with post-blank. To begin with, it was kind of a play on ideas. Postmortem really wound up becoming relevant when the election happened and then when 2016 came to an end and everybody was just collectively like 2016 was the shittiest year. You know what I mean? Like that was a big thing, which I think is silly in and of itself.
So Craig, in your reading, you took postmortem quite literally. It was obviously the work of someone who was close to you and who is now deceased. Mm-hmm. In the submissions that you guys were getting, Brian has already detailed a wide range of possibilities for this. Were you seeing this borne out in the submissions you were getting from people in terms of the themes that they were covering using this broad term of postmortem?
Yes, yeah. And we wanted to leave it open for interpretation, of course. There was a lot that had to do with physical death, but there was also a lot that had to do that was political in it. And it had to do with a wide range of ideas. But like Brian was saying, we realized that postmortem was sort of like poignant for the moment, for the political moment. But we wanted to leave it open for more interpretation. So we made it explicit in the call that it was open for interpretation. And so we decided the next issue we're going to just do, or the next zine, we're going to do an addendum to postmortem, a zine called Post-Vote, to make it a little bit more specific. But yeah, especially in the poetry, I really dug the how people took the theme and really went with it, because it's deep. It really, I was blown away by the quality of stuff we were getting, and just it was a dark and enriching at the same time experience to really go through the submissions. The submissions, were hundreds of them, that were it was a trip to go through all that death.
Speaking of quality, both you and Brian are very high quality live readers of your own work. When you're vetting or seeing this poetry come across, does your instinct kick in saying, this person is an experienced poet? Does that come across the page when you're engaging with it?
It does. First of all, one thing that I'm personally interested in is also the live community aspect of what comes together around the magazine and the process of printing it and then throwing launch parties and the community that is sort of fostered and garnered through the process of having everyone submit the communications.
And just recently, I'm sorry to interrupt, but just recently up at Gamba Forest, the launch party for this very issue had a really great turnout of readers, I believe, who were so all had submitted and got a chance to read their work.
Yeah.
Live.
Majority had submitted. There were a few who hadn't submitted, but the people who we invited to read and perform who hadn't submitted were people who we recognized as being high quality artists and performers who we want actively to be a part of this community.
Yeah, they do. There is a priority for the ones who are in the issue for the launch party. But what's great about the magazine sort of acts as a curatorial process, or mm-hmm. a sieve, mm-hmm. you know, for curating the live shows. And so you do see the quality come across on the page. Yeah, you know, it's some artists are better on the page than they are, you know, reading live. You know, that is too. I try to really like vet them by seeing them live, trying to make a point to see them live. So it's a very, our live shows are very curated in that way. But we're really trying to look for what you could call experimental spoken word artists. Performers who are experimenting stylistically and with their cadence and the way they speak and the way they deliver their poetry. Hmm. And that's one thing I'm interested in sort of getting. And that's what we look for in the submission process too.
Claire, let's talk about images. and specifically how images in issues of post-blank accentuate the written word. What's your approach in editing?
Well, I guess so for Postmortem, it was very interesting because obviously, so we had a lot of images of skulls, of, you know, like bodies. But sometimes I think it wasn't that obvious and it was just like touching a fleshy aspect and something that is very physical, because I think death is like just, you know, what just brings you back to the physicality of your life and that everything's just matter. I mean, I don't believe that, but just like in this, you know, in this, the physicality of death is like the real thing. In terms of image, I think it's, I mean, I grew up and when I've been creating art and I've been writing since I was a kid, and I think I always found that the two are different ways to express something, and I could never choose. I think I'm probably a better visual artist than a writer, probably more experimented in visual art than writing. So I guess for me, the image aspect of it was a lot creating. I'll just tell you how I do it. It's like basically when I've been working on the design of this issue, and basically what I would do is print all the images and all the text and have them spread on my bed and just choose. First, go with one image and like what text would respond to it. But it was also the thing of like finding some stuff that would like talk to each other, but maybe not too directly. So you would have like the image, the text, and then this little something that is created, that this little je ne sais quoi, you say in French, that is created between those two. I don't know if there are any rules. I think it's just like the eye working, and you just see, like, for example, two images or an image and a text together, and you say, oh, it works. You can't even explain why. Just something, there is like a little sparkle between them, I guess. But I think something that we are very proud of with this magazine is to have this, what we call this coherent eclecticism of style in writing and in images. I think it's more obvious with images because it's really something that is direct. We have a lot of different kinds of drawings. We have drawings, we have pictures, we have actually sculptures, because we have like pictures of sculptures that are like pieces themselves. We have like some stuff that are like very funny and very like illustrative, and we have like very fine art paintings. And it's just this way of creating a coherence with things that are going to be very different. I think it's a concept that was always very precious to me, to find a way in the, find a coherence in like a very broad eclecticism, and something that is gonna go to the extremes and then create a whole at the end.
I might add that some of my favorite bands, like Pink Floyd or Me Without You, they a lot of the best bands just have this like visual aspect to them, you know. Represented and you know, with the cover art, the posters and stuff. And so like as a poetry crew, it was very exciting to me to work with Claire and Margot Toluta, because they do have this visual aesthetic about their work, and it's there's a kinship between it, and there's a kinship between the visual art that they have in our words, and it's exciting to me.
Were you the type of youth that would make scrapbooks?
Yeah, I would do that. I think I actually tried to write my first novel when I was 9, and it was very bad. It was cute, but it was very bad. And yeah, I would like mix up. I don't know. I think I always had like a lot of different stuff going on. I was more in doing little worlds, having like an idea. This is actually what I'm still doing as a book artist, like having an idea for like a universe or a story or something and creating all around that. So like having like the story, but then having like drawings or having like found objects or having stuff and then putting them all together. And I think I started off with Legos doing that, and then, yeah.
And it's interesting with Legos, obviously it gives kids a chance for composition, mm-hmm. almost cinematic composition. And I'm glad earlier, Brian, you pointed out the piece that you read, how it sat on the page compared to the imagery next to it, accentuating it across the two pages there. I thought that was, because it really is an amazing accomplishment reading through the pages here. I also wanted to ask you, Claire, about the decision to go with paper. One would think we're living in the digital age. Wouldn't it just be easier to publish something in digital form?
Yeah. I think I love books in their physical forms. So as a book artist, I like make books and use books in my art. I think the physicality of it is... I want people to fucking like shut off their screens and sit in their bed with it. You know what I mean? And not being like... not having any Facebook interruptions or... I don't know, not having like something glowing at their face, you know. I want them to be like kids under the cover with a flashlight. Or I sold one to one of the artists I'm working for, Lisa Stefanelli, and she saw it and she was like, this is like the kind of stuff I want to just like forget about my life, get a glass of wine and a cigarette and sat in my chair and read it through and just forget about my computer. And like she has like 10 businesses at the same time left. So yeah, I think it's, you see a lot of nostalgia for books today, which is, you know, it's like you have nostalgia for vinyls, for example. So, I think it's also, if you want to be like business thing, I think it's also surfing on a wave of like, yeah, people want to touch stuff because we live in such a unmaterial world that people want to hang on to physical things.
Brian, what's your take on reading poetry, reading creative prose, whatever your favorite is, from a paper page compared to a screen?
My eyes hurt less when I read it on the paper. So there's that. I don't know. There's also, it's so easy to navigate as well, because a book, you just turn the pages, you know, you read, you turn the page, you read, you turn the page. Traversing through a website.
Yes.
Right? So websites come in all different forms. So first off, you have to figure out where everything is, right? You have to figure out where the menu is and how to get the different pages. And oftentimes it's really easy, right? When you're looking for your content, you'll see the names like a table of contents and you click on it and it goes right to it, right? With a book, you go through the table of contents and then you have to flip to the page and you get these glimpses of what everything is in front of you, right? So you still get these little previews of all the different pieces of work as you're going through. You don't get that with the website. You click, you're there, you know?
It's more finish.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one major thing too. Yeah, it is more finished. There's that aspect of touch and the aspect of smell and all of that. And these things are linked to memory and to experience, you know. And so in so many ways, at least I've found, I get a lot more out of it when I read from the page. Like physically, I remember more. I enjoy it more. When I'm reading on a screen, I don't remember as much. I don't enjoy it as much. I feel as... I feel like I'm reading an article, you know, like a Facebook article that you click on. You're like, oh, I read that. And you go to something else and you click on another thing. And you read that and you just forget all the information. And then there's also the cultural aspects of it too, right? There's a sense of reward that we feel for finishing a book, right? And that's, you know, that's separate from all of this, but it's still a thing that does exist, you know? So I guess you have to kind of figure out what is absolutely legitimate and what is in itself a kind of construction. But then once you go there, you know, it's, again, it gets difficult to traverse because what is and is not a construction, and that gets really stupid and convoluted, and I'm not going to go into that.
This is why our, by the way, our publication is called Post Blank, because of this kind of, what does it all mean anyway?
Yeah.
It's post-modern.
Yeah, exactly.
Asking the big questions.
Oh,
I like that.
I mean, what else are you supposed to do? But that's my spiel.
Paper, I get like it's almost induced ADD when it comes to like the internet and reading stuff online. I'm trying to read poetry online, first everything, for some reason, not of any fault of its own, of what I'm reading, but it just feels more trivial when I'm reading it on a web page. When it's in a book, it feels more substantial. But if I'm scrolling through my phone, if I'm on my tablet and I'm trying to read this poem, I will get distracted by something. There will be that push notification. I will learn that, you know, Trump just pissed off North Korea, you know, and you know, I'll just check Facebook and I'll get lost doing that for the next 2 hours and I will have forgotten about your poem, you know.
And to that point, the times that I've seen you read, you usually, if you're not doing it off the top of your head, it's from a page almost always, correct?
Yeah. I've... I don't know why I just have an aversion to reading off my phone. It's not really rational. But
is it handwritten or do you type?
I type, and it has to be in Courier New Font.
I love that. I hope you're serious about that, because that's great.
He's completely serious. I have some sheets of his paper at home, and it's all in Courier, and it's just really funny.
I will waste many 50 cents here and there at the FedEx changing the font and all the pages.
I think it's Courier, which actually means mail.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Claire, it also begs the question, what is the font of Postmortem? And
oh, my God. I think it's actually called Avenir. Avenir. Do you guys have this word?
I don't know.
Future means future.
Yeah.
And so we have actually two fonts. We have Avenir for the bodies, and we have this old style font that is actually the font of the logo, and that looks like old type, old press types, like old books. I love this font. I mean, I use it maybe too much, but I love it.
Is it appealing to a reader? Is it easy on the eyes?
So Margot, I think, like, set a lot of like the design line on the first issue, because she was the one mainly working on the design of the first issue. So she chose this font.
Margot Talleux.
Margot Talleux, who's in Paris right now. Hey, Margot, salut. If tu nous écoutes, I think you know it. So it's a like sans serif, like without serif, which means it's. Sans empattement, we say in French. So it's like very simple letters, like Arial, basically. Mm. You know, you don't have the fancy little things around the letters. And yeah, it's just, I think, easy to read. It's basic enough to fit a lot of styles and a lot of themes, because we're going to try to stick to it. But it's a little less boring than Arial or Helvetica.
Claire, sticking with you, you have a physical issue of Postmortem in front of you. I'm fascinated by the cover. Tell me about it.
I'm going to describe it for people listening. We actually have this soil texture on it. I don't know if it was obvious, but it is soil. And the logo. So the logo is actually an old press type. I think it was just like something nice that you put in old books. So like one of those metal types.
It's like a stamp. Right?
Yeah, that we just used, like we just blew up for the logo. Kind of looked like a barcode, actually, so I think it's pretty funny. But yeah, the soil texture, I really like just having a texture on the cover, and like no like big titles or no like features, you know, because we have like, for example, we have some Valérie Hamon work in that. Like Valérie Hamon is a pretty well-known printmaker. Like she's one of Kiki Smith's friends. She was my teacher at NYU, actually. So it's like, we have names, you know, we could advertise it like in magazines and like, yeah, featuring blah, blah. No, I think we wanted something. There is, we say sober in French, which is sober, but it's not drunk. It's just simple. And yeah, and the soil texture, I guess it's, you know, just this idea of like soil is like, so yeah, you're buried in the soil most of the time when you're dead. But so like soil is like this symbol of death, but it's also so full of life in so many ways, and that's where you die and you go back to life in a way. It's my thinking, which is a little weird, but I just think that you never truly die.
It's a sturdy texture, it's a sturdy issue. It can hold up to some punishment if people want to take it with them on the road or it out in the wilderness or something like that. It's not gonna evaporate easily, I think.
You know,
I mean, paper is paper.
A point on that, which was kind of funny, we were a little bit worried about that because when we first got the proofs of the book, right? Because like the printer prints over at the Internet Garage, which is on Bedford Avenue and what is it, like North Fifth Street?
Mm-hmm.
Just a printing place that also prints books as well as just regular paper stuff. They gave us the proofs first, and the proofs are usually notoriously weaker, of course, you know what I mean? Like, they fall apart a little bit more quickly when you get proofs of famous books. They're like these shitty paper covers that have no design, you know, and a bunch of grammatical mistakes because it hasn't been properly edited. And so we were just flipping through it one evening and immediately saw all these creases and all this, you know, you could see the binding and the glue in between the pages, and we were like really disappointed right at first. But then once the actual books came in, it was beautiful. But there was that. No, it is. It is. You're right. It's very sturdy. But we were a little worried right at first when we got the proofs. But turned out sturdy beautifully. Mean? Sturdy is strong.
Oh, strong. Okay.
Yeah. What strikes me about it, the way you look at it, it is sleek and sober, sexy. But the size of it, and then the soil sort of texture and the composition, and then the logo on the front, which in its own way sort of looks like a coffin in contrast. It's intriguing. It's sort of like you're staring into your own 6 feet deep sort of burial plot.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear you guys talk about this, because for people to embark on this in this day and age, it's very interesting to see your approach to the tactile reception and the first impression, essentially, that your readers are going to get.
There is like this word, a MOOC, which is like this hybrid between a magazine and a book. I don't know if you guys have a lot of those in the United States, but we had like a few publications before I left France like that. And I was always fascinated by those. So you have no advertisement, which was like amazing. Of course, it's like most of the time publications. We had this publication, I think it's called 13, maybe I'm wrong. But it's like informative. It's like those very long political articles, but are like very, you know, like searched and very interesting, but with like beautiful illustration, beautiful design. And it's like a magazine because you have like issues, but it's still something that you're going to keep as a book. I don't know. I like when people buy it or get it in their hand and they caress the cover like that. Yeah. And they're like, oh, you know, it's like they don't really know what to expect. They don't really know if it's a book, if it's a magazine, if it's a zine, if it's
There's something about the texture where it's sort of like it's not quite like a gloss. It's almost like a papery sort of matte feel, but sort of glossy the cover is. So it does sort of have that mook kind of feel.
I am actually also really glad about the fact there's not a single piece of gloss anywhere around this. I hate that gloss look. GQ magazine and Time magazine and like, okay, Time magazine's great in its own right, but like I really don't like that glossy feel and that glossy look. It just looks way too expensive and then it falls apart really easily.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, I feel like it's kind of tacky.
Yeah, in the publishing world, it is kind of like we were talking about the divisiveness of the Oxford comma before.
Oh yeah. Jesus.
When it comes to gloss, it's interesting. There, I've definitely heard people who go both ways on it in terms of publishing. There's people who feel like it robs paper of its earthy soul, you know, its texture soul. Other people who say, because of the pragmatic benefits of being able to flip pages fast, for colors to pop more, that sort of stuff.
It's interesting because it kind of feels like then you could see that glossy being like screens. And you know how like people who design apps and websites, they try to get rid of what we call friction. So like people like, you know, like this, the thing of like, you don't really know where to look and this is like the friction in your brain. And it's like your brain like that because it has to work. And so the gloss would be like the same for a page. Like you don't have to work too much to turn the page. So it's like this fast thing. I want people to work to turn the page. Yeah. I want them to like get like, oh, you know.
And as Brian pointed out, people are going to turn it and sample as they flip through the pages anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So to slow them down a little bit.
Yeah.
By having that texturous feeling,
cool,
probably
actually.
Does it.
Yeah. Plus, anyways, I don't think there's anything wrong with aspects of friction and frustration. I think it kind of creates an interesting relationship with a piece. I mean, if you're going for absolute gratification, then fucking don't, you know, you're not going to look for something on death if you're looking for instant gratification.
Even a book, you know? I think, is some object of frustration. It's also something that I like about it. It's like you don't get it all just by look. You have to go through it. You have to engage physically with it. You have to turn the pages to take the time to read it.
Claire's medium, I don't know if we said this before, is book art, mm-hmm. which was appealing to me to work with her because, you know, I wanted my poems to sort of, and the books that I make to sort of take a form of book art. And, you know, book art being the book itself is a piece of art.
Taking up on that note, Craig, the idea of once a person has enjoyed it and they can keep it, do you guys have a vision for how you'd like people to store this Is this like a coffee table thing? Is this something where they can present it?
Very much a coffee table.
Yeah. Yes. I want people in fancy houses to have that on their fancy coffee table and have their fancy friends come around and be like, ooh, that's cool.
Which is fun because we sort of like wanted it to be like this object that not only transcends medium and genre, but also like is like transcends like class, you know, like we can do it. It's a DIY thing. You know, we're all working people. We work like 50 hours a week, you know, like, you know, and we're all doing this in our spare time gradually, you know, and we do these events, you know, at like bookstores or galleries, but sort of DIY events, you know, and it's also in the Albertine French Cultural Embassy bookstore
of the cultural services of the French embassy Central Park,
and we sell it for like $25 at our events. You know, that's a pretty high price for a magazine, you know, but it does well, and it, because there's so much that goes into it, and people are excited about the shows are exciting. There's a lot of excitement that builds around it. It's sort of the anticipation builds up to these parties.
And before we get back to a final round of readings, tell me about some of the stats, so to speak, of this book. How many people's works are in here? How many pages?
Well, there's 144 pages.
Yeah, the first issue was almost 100 pages. This is 144 pages. 144. How many artists do we have in here?
We have some more like...
More than 100.
Well,
artists.
I think that's also included in post-vote, though, that count. I think there's maybe...
It's probably like between 90 and 100 artists slash writers in the issue.
And then imagery is very prevalent as well in there. It's almost as many images, would you say, as pages?
Well, that's
or half
kind
as
of,
many as because you open up and there's words and pages.
That's kind of what we're pushing for, you know? There's because it's not an anthology. You know, it's not a book of poetry or a book of writing. I mean, as Craig said, as I'm sure Claire said, Claire was one of the first people to say it like this in this group. It's a curated piece, you know, so the book in itself is almost like its own mini gallery, if you will, trying to create some form of a coherent narrative. But that is also sort of, well, you know, Claire's word, coherent eclecticism. And I think that that's important.
Yeah, and we also, we were talking about flipping through. We did want to create something, you know, a composition to where as you do flip through, it's sort of the images are well dispersed throughout that and complementing the words so that it is visually stimulating as you flip.
And I didn't even think of this. Were these images also submitted? Did you have a call for images as well?
Yes.
We have a call for art and poetry, but we are like very, we really like word art specifically. So like, for example, what Billy Kensel does is amazing. Like this kind of, so he's a poet, but he's going to do like pieces like that when he's going to like have stuff printed and he's going to rewrite on it and draw on it and like do a lot of physical thing on the text and then send this back to us.
So it's visual art that utilizes words. And we try to look for a lot of that in our aesthetic.
There's this page in here that almost looks like it came straight from a zine. And it's part of the aesthetic that I really like that's going on in that each and every single double page that you witness is in itself kind of its own... I don't know, its own story, you know, its own construction. So what you see here is you see there's a photograph of a window with what seems like a map drawn over it and then a poem, like almost like pieces of paper with lines of poetry torn off and then Xeroxed on the page. And then on the other side, you have almost a black and white sort of 50s comic book style aesthetic that creates this very sort of DIY zine sort of feeling. And it's the only double page in the book that has that aesthetic going on, but I really appreciate it because I feel like it accentuates the idea of each double page itself presenting a unique interpretation of the theme.
Watching from across the table as you flip through the issue, the diversity, the vast diversity of those images, before you even see the care that was taken for curating those images with the themes of the words that they're paired with, is really apparent in terms of just the different shapes that I'm seeing of not just the art, but the words. There's spirals of words sometimes. Mm-hmm. There's words that are set within shapes, and there's words that are set within silhouettes, as we've already, as I already mentioned. All kinds of things. It's really a dynamic composition, and I'm glad that you guys are embarking on this. Let's close with a final round of readings. So, Craig, what are you going to read?
I'm going to read a piece called My Color Keeps Killing Its God Again. It's on page 77 of the issue. It's in response to images on the page that are by Elena Berriello. My color keeps killing its god again. My anger keeps killing its president. My red shoots two Corinthians on Fifth Avenue and nails Protestant, vote down in the wrists. Keeps killing its dad, wants whatever billionaires have. My green pukes envy on the shoes of drunk hotel where conflict of interest sleeps. Both its sons have slicked back hair. Corpses, corsets, orbits Massachusetts where Romney did Obamacare first. My color keeps killing its god again. Turns my baby Jesus blue with booze. My black eye won't let me believe again. My gulch turns its shower head to nightmare. Turns my male gaze into a horde. My white went to the beach and came back with pink. My gray went to Russia and came back with a ghost.
Thank you, Craig. Moving over to Claire. Claire, what are you going to read?
So I'm going to read Of the Things You Do Not Know from Maureen Siegel, who actually lives in Paris, who was at our Paris launch, and who has been submitting for the first issue in this one. So it's in English. I don't know if she's French, but she's obviously a French speaker, and she wrote that in English. Of the Things You Do Not Know. No one rents movies anymore. Nobody smokes or drinks skim milk. No one eats margarine. Down on Magnolia, Luigi still has a barber shop, but his hands are starting to shake. Ginsburg is still on the court. Pluto is no longer a planet. Soon, they say, we will travel to Mars. Despite the extra lane, Highway 40 continues to bottleneck at rush hour. Your mother is dead. I am divorced. Your brother still sighs when he smiles. Mexican shops and cafes have opened on Cherokee, down by the river. No one says yuppie these days. The economy crashed. There have been earthquakes and wars. We, personally, have been spared. There was outrage at Wall Street and now with the cops who shot a boy up in Ferguson. We elected a black man president. You would never guess who got elected next. Contrary to your predictions, I do not make much money. I do not have a 401k. I do not own a home. In 2000, the world did not end. She was the one who found you. After she redid the bathroom and sold the house, the neighbors bought it and tore everything up but the pine that we planted near the creek. The creek is gone. The coral court is gone. The 66 drive-in too. A tornado ripped up Joplin. A hurricane flooded New Orleans. Buildings fell in New York and nothing has been the same ever since. Flights are unreasonably cheap. I have traveled to Moscow for work and once went to Portugal with a man that I loved. I speak in a foreign language and live in a foreign land. Also, I have started to sing. The Pope is from Argentina. The church got in trouble in Boston. The people of Paris are tense. There are refugees sleeping on the sidewalk and others are dying at sea. There once was an Arab Spring. Cancer may soon be cured and could be due to stress and plastic. Fracking is hard to explain. The Arctic is in a bad state. The oceans are angry. Your sister was angry too because they would not let her carry you. No one told me our clothes would be cut. I had never heard dirt make that sound. I speak no Hebrew, but can still say the words to your prayer. I alone call your son by his name. On Sundays, we talk over the ocean on a screen and we make each other laugh. I learned that Uncle Henry escaped from a train on his way to a camp, that you lived in California for a while, that it hurt when you lost the two girls. Smoked salmon is as good as you said it would be. In the future, we will probably eat insects, but for now, chocolate bacon is a thing. Every Thanksgiving, I make sweet potato pie. I love a little boy with exactly your hands and your name. I once spent a week at St. Joseph with a mysterious disease, but they fixed it, and now I'm fine. You do not know it, but we are all finally fine.
Thank you, Claire. Brian, what are you going to read?
So I'm going to read a short story submitted by Malik Crumpler. He's an amazing writer. He submitted actually quite a few pieces. We accepted something like four of them, but two of them wound up getting accepted at another place, which, you know, is too bad for us. Great for the other publication, because he's fantastic. The story is very short, and I think it's very beautiful, fantastic, wonderful imagery. So this story is called Waiting for Rahim. Not much on earth sleep like this barn do. But that ain't saying nothing. Not much on earth hang about itself like this here peeling gray paint do. But that ain't saying nothing either. Not much on earth colored like my horse. Not even them deers in summer. Now that's something to witness. What about it, though? I'd be done, used up all the words I got if I don't get careful. Hay always hay unless it burn. Then it's just fire. Rahim had to leave the bar. Everything on four legs love hay except them growlers. You know them wolves and lions and all. That ain't what keep me up these past months. Rahim saved all this from me. I ain't never seen a thing on earth what ain't got no color. When I was a young smart ass, if I heard something say all that, I'd be the first to call it a lie and holler out glass, water, or spiderweb. Family of spiders up in here. I don't bother 'em. They some creative critters, ain't they? I ain't never pay no attention to no man scared of spiders. Hard to take a woman serious either when she say they bites can send you home, maybe to a baby. I'd be done left over 1,000 times this year alone if that was true. See now, I lives in and owns this here barn, but it belonged to them spiders. I used to could watch 'em before my eyes quit me. What color they was then? All kinds of colors. Nowadays, I can't recall narrow one. I figure to make it up just fine. They's a color of night to me. Some say webs ain't got no color, but they does when something get God in 'em, or that morning gold help it express itself. Them spider webs is slick, I tell you. They even let that old moon dress 'em up when the sun go on and give it to the other side of the world. Ain't much concerned with lies no more like I used to be. Know why? Cause I'm older than I can count now. Hell, I'm older than every lie or truth I ever known. Nowadays, I be just staring at all the things that ain't got nothing to do with dreams or fantasies. I keep to my horse and these here spiders. My horse night colored too. When I was a young fool, I believed in the color of black, but ain't no black other than shadows and fresh earth. These days, I don't do nothing but watch and listen and sip deer-colored whiskey and sit and wait for Rahim to show up over there, where our folks always rise colorless but in uniform fresh out the web.
To learn more about Post Blank and how you can purchase a copy of the first two volumes, please go to madgleampress.com/postblank. That's all for this episode of Talking Paper. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.